Good morning. My name is John Smetanka, and the name of our program is With Respect. This morning's guest on With Respect are three men who were part of a reunion that I attended with my brother in northeastern Michigan, Gladwin. And it's the reunion of the 16th PI, Public Information, Division for the, and these folks were in Vietnam, back in the day when the war was going on. And we're going to be talking to them about where they came from, what happened when they were in Vietnam, what they did, and then after they left, what did they take out of it? What happened to their lives afterwards? The three guests today are Don Sokol, who for many years was with the Providence Journal, both in regular print journalism and also in the radio branch. He did some radio work with the Providence Journal. We'll talk about that. Frank Gottlieb, who for many years was involved in broadcast and radio and television. Cliff Hauser, who is the host of this event here in Gladwin. And he is spent many years in radio and had a jazz show which spanned his time in Vietnam, but most recently, he was a public relations firm by the name of Hauser and Hennessy. This is the group. We want to talk about their experiences and their lives and why we're here this evening. With respect. So, gentlemen, how are you this morning?
Good.
Good.
Well. Good, good. Good. I want to start off by asking you, Cliff, to tell us why we're here. What was this all about and how you all guys tied together?
Well, we were in a unique situation to begin with because we were blessed to have backgrounds in advertising, marketing, radio, television, and newspaper management. As we entered the Vietnam War, and we were fortunate because we were allowed to practice our crafts in the war, so it was a good opportunity for like-minded people of the same professions to get together. And it was a small group, a detachment of about 20 men, assigned to 2nd Field Forces, which was the largest fighting unit in the world. Comprised of many of the famous divisions, the 9th, the 25th Infantry, the Big Red One, the cavalry units, all of that. And bottom line is we covered the 3rd Corps tactical zone of Vietnam, and we covered the war and then disseminated stories to civilian press as well as Armed Forces Vietnam Network. So we were together 45, 46 years ago. And our unit group essentially comprises those guys who were there in 69 and 70. And many of us have stayed in touch together. And then a year and a half ago, Don Sokol and I said, well, why don't we try to get together and get a reunion going? So bottom line is we did exactly that and went on the internet and started finding brothers. We found 3-4 of them had been deceased over the time. And we had a really good turnout on the first go-round up at my ranch in West Branch a year ago, so we decided to do it at my lake home in Gladwin this year, and that's how we ended up here.
Well, now, to give people a focus, the 3 Corps, in Vietnam, it was broken up into 4 Corps, 1, 2, 3, and 4. 1 was up around Hue in the north. And 3 Corps was around Saigon, as I recall. Am I correct?
It went essentially from Dong Tam in the Mekong Delta up north to Tay Ninh, Vietnam, west to the Cambodian border, and east to the South China Sea. It was the largest of the corps where we were involved in combat in Nam.
You created not only a magazine, which was called The Hurricane, as I recall, but you also did reporting of all different kinds. That, as you talked about, you disseminated things to the public as well. But what was The Hurricane?
The Hurricane was a full-color magazine, similar to like a mini Time magazine, doing color and cover stories of lifestyles in Vietnam, much more so than direct combat, trying to field out human information about lifestyle. And Don and the other print correspondents essentially contributed articles to that and photography to that, while those of us who were involved in the electronic side were out doing broadcast stories for radio and television, which were then subsequently distributed to the nightly news, civilian press, or AFVN in Saigon. And then I had a weekly show on Armed Forces Network called Dateline 3 Corps, which was a similar deal to like 60 Minutes or whatever, where there were special interest stories which I covered throughout the tactical zone from a human interest, and did stories that went on the radio. So our little group, band of brothers, we had a diverse outlook on really what was going on, and we kind of looked for, we weren't looking for the blood and guts, but we were looking for the humanity side of what was going on in Vietnam. And then our print commanding officer was a guy by the name of George Cox, who was an airborne ranger, West Point captain, and he had the dubious job once a month of flying to Tokyo and putting the magazine together.
Oh, poor baby.
Yeah, poor baby.
That was, and as I recall hearing last night, the story went that he was there 2 weeks of every month to put the magazine out.
Yeah, he wanted to make sure all of our belt buckles were in line while he was back, and once he got that accomplished, he went back to Japan. Yeah.
It took a lot of photoshopping to make sure it was just right.
He actually received a letter of commendation from President Nixon, citation for our unit, presidential citation. So, kidding aside, he did a great job, and he's still a great patriot.
I'd like to jump in here about George Cox, because last year...
Could you lean forward?
This is Don. Last year he was here, and some of the guys remembered him as something of a martinet, and he was our most delightful surprise. He was a very human guy, and he told us when he got the award from President Nixon, he was there, and he told us, I think he said, you guys tell me if I'm wrong, I think he said he actually cried. He choked up because he felt that we were the ones, the guys in the unit, who had done the work. Mm-hmm. That earned the award, that he was only the overseer of it, the moderator, so to speak, and that we deserved the award and he did not deserve it. He was such a modest, he just came across as such a wonderful human being, and he went on to found a group that's dedicated to the memory of, not in a memorial sense, in a scholarship sense, of Alexander Hamilton. And I know that he would love for us to mention that, because he's out on the West Coast. And this society devoted to Alexander Hamilton prompts research, and, you know, it's a rather scholarly thing. Yeah. And so I just wanted to point out that about Cox, that he... Well, he had that humanity to him.
You know, we're going to be talking about a number of people and things that happened that bring emotion to this. But before we do that, I'm going to give some background. Frank Gottlieb, tell me about yourself. How did you start off in life? I presume you didn't start off with a pencil and paper as you came out of your mother's womb.
No, but I did start quite young. And by that I mean I caught the broadcast bug rather young, back when I was in high school. And when I went to college at Duquesne University in Pittsburgh, I took up journalism. And the day after graduation, literally the day after I received my diploma, this, of course, was during the draft, and I had a surprise letter from Uncle Sam in the mail.
Surprise. Graduation. Congratulations.
Congratulations. Come on down.
That's right. And you saw that first word in the letter, which everybody laughs about. Congratulations. You are now going to join Uncle Sam.
Well,
greetings. All right. Greetings.
I knew what it was. I did not open it. I called my friends. I said, come on over. I don't want to open this up alone.
How old were you?
Around 22, 21, 22. Mm-hmm. I was of legal drinking age at that time.
What year was that?
1968.
Okay.
And this was maybe 5 months after the Tet Offensive.
Yeah, that was in February of 1968.
Correct.
But now you graduated, you get the message, you're coming to join Uncle Sam. What happened?
And of course, when you're drafted, it's not a sure ticket to Vietnam, but there was a better than even chance you would be sent over. I didn't think I would pass my draft physical, and I did. And they took me in, and I went through basic training, and they didn't send me to school, any sort of school. They knew my background, and I got out of basic training with the MOS, which is the military occupation specialty, MOS of 71R20, same as Cliff has, which is broadcast specialist. And they shipped me off from basic training at Fort Jackson off to Fort Jackson, South Carolina, off to Fort Carson, Colorado, where they did not know what to do with me. Send me home. Well, you can work in the office here. And I got an Army projection license and showed movies while I was out in Colorado. They did have an information office on the base, but they didn't have any openings. So I was with one of the artillery batteries. And I was there 6 months or so, and then got the orders to ship over to Vietnam.
So you ended up coming straight to this unit, that the 16th?
Straight to the 16th, and I really feel I couldn't have been more blessed with people like Don, Cliff, and the others who are here at the reunion, having leadership like Colonel Abbott Morgan, who was head of the 16th Public Information Detachment, Captain Cox, Lieutenant Babcock, Lieutenant Watson, Sergeant Taylor, who was in charge of the whoever saw the broadcast unit with Lieutenant Babcock, and also our Sergeant Major, Ernest Bradley. You know, good people all.
Don, how did you get started in journalism before you got shipped over?
I went to Michigan State University. I had grown up in New York City. And at 17, I came out to Michigan. I fell in love with Michigan. It was, you know, I was from the city, and I liked the city. I loved the city. But there was something just so fresh and wonderful. I remember it was very exotic to me. I landed at the Lansing Airport, which I think was a little smaller in those days, and took a cab to get to campus. And I remember passing the John Deere, a John Deere showman out in the countryside, and I thought, wow, this is like heaven. I pictured it. It was a movie starring Jimmy Stewart and Gene Crane, and I don't even know who Gene Crane is, but names just come to me, Main Street or something, and I just loved it. So I worked for the school newspaper, and after I graduated, I decided that I did not want to get drafted. I was married, and I didn't want to get drafted. Who did? And I guess those who did enlisted. And I decided to, I got hired by the Detroit school system as a substitute teacher. And teachers were exempt from the draft. And as luck would have it, a special education teacher had a maternity leave. And they made me a permanent sub, meaning I went in every single day. I had no teaching credentials, and I taught at Hutchins Junior High School. And that's very relevant, that's very important, because, well, for a couple of reasons. First of all, I taught a class of special education students. I was not properly trained. It did not serve the students well. I did my best, but I wasn't a trained educator. My wife was. After 6 months of doing that, I decided, as often in my life, I think of the obvious later, I say, well, wait a minute. I'll have to do this until I'm 35, which sounds like an enormous span of time at the age of 21, in order to avoid the draft. At 35, I'll be exempt. I'd rather be drafted. I don't want to do this for 15 years. And so I left. I got hired by Booth Newspapers, and I was working at the Ypsilanti Press and the Ann Arbor paper, the Ann Arbor News. And during the summer of the Detroit riots of
67,
and I went back to visit one of my students after the riots were over, but Detroit was an occupied city. And I remember coming to Hutchins Junior High, where I had taught. And that was headquarters for, there were tanks. There were armored personnel carriers patrolling the streets, and it was creepy seeing an American city. And I visited my student and his mother, who lived in the second floor of a wooden tenement, and they told me how fearful they were, how scared they were, and how frightening this was to them. And later I went back to, of course, it was just a visit, and I went to a meeting of the Ann Arbor Housing Authority to cover it a short time later. And before the meeting began, some people were talking, and they were just making small talk before the meeting. And I remember them talking about the riots, and there was a woman. To be honest, I'm a liberal myself, but this was the worst kind of liberal, an ideologue kind of person, who they were talking about the riots and how horrible. Somebody said, oh, it's horrible in there. Their homes were, you know, homes were burned down. And I thought of the visit to my student and his mother, junior high school age student, and his mother. And their fear and their anxiety about what was going on. They were not happy about the riots. And this woman said, well, they don't care. It's not their house. It's not their property. They don't have a stake in it. And I thought, this woman, as many ideologues do, whether it's right or left, don't have a sense of the humanity of the thing. Whether you're a liberal and you think that, you know, one side doesn't have sympathy for immigrants who come to this country, or you're a conservative who thinks that liberals don't have an understanding of the way life really works, they live in an ivory tower. In this particular case, I remember how infuriating it was. In any case, I taught, you know, I worked at Booth Newspapers for a while, and then it hit me, I can't have this hanging over my head indefinitely. And life will go on, and then when I'm 25, I'll be drafted. It's just going to be worse and worse. I volunteered for the draft. So I went in the service, I volunteered for the draft, I went to Fort Knox, Kentucky. And my sense of it was that by that time there was such anti-war feeling in the company that they were very sensitive to us. They were very sensitive to the political vibes of the people who were being drafted, because they had exhausted the poor people. And now they were starting to get college graduates and people who might have been a little rebellious. And I remember when I was in basic training, I read a story in the newspaper Robert Kennedy made a speech, and it just gives me chills, and we think of the rhetoric we hear in politics today. Listen to these words from the anti-war Robert Kennedy. It's hard to believe that we had politicians who could speak this way. And I'm reading in the paper, and he said, "Let history not say of us, as Tacitus said of the Romans, they made a desert, and they called it peace." My God.
Good line. So did you were then sent over after your training, you were sent over to the 16th?
No, initially I didn't have to go to advanced training. I was lucky. I was really lucky from the get-go. Right from basic training, I was sent to Fort Campbell, Kentucky, where I worked on the Post newspaper for more than a year. And at that time, I was very young, and it was exotic for me to live in the South. I was in Kentucky on the Tennessee line. I went to the Grand Ole Opry, the old one, and it was very exciting. And one of the most fascinating stories I ran into was there was a part-time carpenter who helped the Post Museum. The Post Museum at Fort Campbell, the home of the 101st Airborne Division of World War II renown, was a German. He had been a German soldier who had been captured in North Africa. And here he was at the 101st Airborne home base, whose museum was dedicated to their exploits in World War II. Mm. And he told me his story. He had gone back to Germany at the end of the war. First of all, he enjoyed being a prisoner, and he remembered he was treated very well. And he told me a story of how he was out working on a... They used to take them out working on area farms, and one day he was guided by a... They had a guard, a soldier with a rifle, who accompanied seven or eight of them, and they went to the farm to work, and the soldier who was guarding them, the young soldier, was making time with the proverbial farmer's daughter. And he told the my friend Fritz, who I was interviewing, and the other guides, he said, "Listen, I'm going to be seeing, I'm going inside with the farmer's daughter, and here's my rifle. And you guys can shoot cans off the fence or something till, you know, I'll come out, and then we'll get on about our work." And I expressed incredulity, and I said, "Really? I mean, he gave you his rifle?" And Fritz said, "Where were we going to go? This is such a huge country. I mean, we weren't going to escape anywhere." And in any case, he went back to Germany, and he met a war widow. Her husband had been killed in the war, German, and she had a daughter. And he married her, and the daughter became his daughter, and the daughter grew up, and it came to pass that she met a soldier who was stationed in Germany, an American soldier of the 101st Airborne Division, home base, Fort Campbell, Kentucky. They fell in love, they married. A year later, or some time passed, and he's recalled to the United States. He's going to go back to his to Fort Campbell. The mother was terribly distraught. People weren't flying back and forth to Europe all the time in those days. It was, I don't know, 1950, whatever it was. And, well, it would have been, like, older. And she was very distraught. She said, "I'll never see my daughter again." He said, "No, let's move to the United States. I was a prisoner in Fort Campbell. It was wonderful." So I was there for a year, and then I had another week or two left before they had a rule. If you have less than 8 months left, they can't send you to Vietnam. That's the way I recall it. Well, I had just about 8 months left that I got the call. So I was sent over, and I was so fortunate because the officers who I worked for at Fort Campbell, they thought well enough of me, or poorly enough of my prospects of what could happen to me in Vietnam, that their colonel knew the guy the colonel who was running the 16th PID and said, "We got a good man. We're sending a guy over. You want him. He does a good job." And so I was assigned there.
Before we get to talk about Cliff and your background, how you got to where you, when you got to Vietnam, we're going to take a break. We're talking to Don Sokol, Frank Gottlieb, and Cliff Hauser, who are at a reunion of the 16th PID, Public Information Department or Division, of the 2nd Field Force in Vietnam during the period, the late 60s and the beginning of the 70s. This is John Smetanka. The name of our program is With Respect, and we'll be right back. We're now back on With Respect with Don Sokol, Frank Gottlieb, and Cliff Hauser. Each of these fellows are veterans of the Vietnam War in the area of public information, putting together the Hurricane magazine, but also many news reports and broadcasts coming out of the Vietnam War while it was going on. We've talked to each of these folks about their background, except for Cliff, we haven't talked to him yet about how he got into journalism. By the way, this is John Smetanka, and the name of our program is With Respect. Cliff, tell us, were you born into journalism, or did you happen into it?
Well, from the time I was just a young kid, I always wanted to be in radio. I was fascinated by radio stations, used to visit them, and back then in the early to mid-60s, you had to have an engineer's license in order to really work in radio. But the Federal Communications Commission really didn't care how old you were if you could pass the test. So I played hooky from school one day, and my mother took me to Grand Rapids, and I took the radio engineer's test, passed it, and got my radio engineer's license. So by the time I was a junior in high school, I was working about 30 hours a week at the local radio station and really enjoying it. And then...
Where was this?
That was WMRP Radio in Flint. And then while I was there, I got a call from the senior announcer at Channel 5 in Saginaw, WNEM, and said, we need an announcer. And I said, well, that would be me.
So no, never shy, right?
No, so I started with NBC in Saginaw December 18th, 1965. And this was a matter of 5 months after I graduated high school. And I was going to college during the day and doing a late night jazz show from 4 to midnight every night. And ended up getting married, had a baby on the way, and along came Vietnam. So I ended up going into the service in 1968 and completed basic training, and everybody else has had orders to go somewhere except me. And they had interviewed me after I took all the barrage of tests and everything, and they'd offered me a direct commission as an officer. And I said, you know what, pal, that would be nice, but that would be another 10 months I don't intend to give away from my wife and son, so that's just not going to work. So I said, you can either give me the job you know that I can do best for the Army, or I can carry a rifle. I really don't care which, but I'm leaving when my time is up. So I finished basic training, and everybody else got orders, and I waited 2 weeks for orders, and finally my commanding officer says, well, man, it says here broadcast specialist, and you're going to the John F. Kennedy Center for Special Warfare, Fort Bragg, North Carolina. So I ended up there with a top secret security clearance, and I was writing scripts for psychological warfare in a building that had a facade on it as though it was a radio station outside, but it wasn't. So I was writing scripts, and about 10 o'clock every night, the Vietnamese translators came in, and they read my scripts onto tape, and then those tapes were shipped off to Vietnam to play over villages by Psychological Warfare Battalion. And then I ended up coming down on orders for Nam to replace a correspondent in Vietnam who was leaving. So I ended up at... the 16th Public Information Detachment, and immediately, within a matter of days, I was out in the field with my other broadcast brothers here covering a variety of stuff. So, and then following Vietnam, I went back to my job, which had been held open for me at NBC, and went back on the air, and then ultimately got off the air and became an account executive handling the business side of WNEM's business, and as my interest in that side of the business grew, I had clients that said, well, why don't you do all my advertising and not just the TV and radio? So back in the 70s, I formed a television production company and began producing radio and television commercials. And then in 1986, I formed a full-service advertising agency, radio, television, print, direct mail, outdoor, and geared staff up and ended up with Buick Motor Division and 7-Eleven Corporation and Little Caesars Pizza, among 100 others, and really had a lot of fun in the advertising side of it. So that's kind of my claim to fame.
Well, this is, that takes you through after Vietnam, and I want to do quick with you, Don. Your afterwards was what?
I went to work for the Providence Journal in Rhode Island, stayed there for 35 years. The paper was beginning to shrink, they reorganized, and I lost my job at the age of 62. And I was pretty happy. You know, newspapers have changed. And then I began teaching part-time at a local technical college, teaching English, teaching writing. And I really loved it. And I just retired full-time this year in January.
Frank, how about you?
Well, earlier I neglected to mention that I was doing underground radio.
Underground radio.
Before being drafted, Country Joe and the Fish, you know, Feel Like I'm Fixing to Die Rag, Alice's Restaurant, and the like, on a regular station, WAMO, WAMO FM in Pittsburgh, 72,000 watts on FM, and the show was only on a couple hours at night, but it's what I was doing before I was drafted, and I was afraid someone in the Army would know what kind of show I was doing, and you know, they would send me right to the front. But well, you know, there were times I was, but when I got out of the Army, naturally at that time, if somebody was drafted, there was a law saying that a job had to be held. And I went back. There had been a format change at the station. The program director I worked for was no longer there. And I was made to feel uncomfortable enough that I began looking for other employment. And I lucked out, got a job working weekends news writing at a little TV station called KDKA-TV.
All right.
And
which was the first radio and television station in the country. That's why he's laughing.
Allegedly the first.
Yeah.
There's a station in Detroit that claims they were first. One in L.A.
Yeah.
And the one I ended up working at for 27 years predates KDKA. They weren't licensed, but they were on the air first. But that's another story, another show. I was working there part-time. I was hired away full-time across town by WTAE-TV, which was the station where I interned when I was in college. And from there moved on to the NBC station in Columbus. While in Columbus, I hooked up with Cube, which would be a good story in itself. That was the first interactive cable system.
All right.
Where people had a box and they were able to interact with the TV shows on the air. We could ask polling questions. This was back in the days of the Gong Show. We had a show called Talent Search, and people could vote on the talent in real time during the program.
Let me lead you on to something. Now, last night we talked about what went on when you were there. What kind of stories you covered? You talked about Cliff. You talked about going out and getting the human interest stories that that were not blood and guts, but there was something else about the...
What did you cover? For example, a lot of persons that have seen various movies are familiar with the river patrol boats that ran the Mekong River south of Saigon and the Delta, the PBRs they were called, and rather than go down and do a study about how we can shoot up villages from the water, I went down and did a story on a guy who was a coxswain or in control of the boat, and where he was from, what he thought of his job, and his life on the river, and their innovations for living on and off a boat in 120 degree temperatures with mosquitoes. And the story started out with Otis Redding sitting on the dock of the bay, and then it was kind of a chit-chat, Charles Kuralt kind of a story. I did another story about a guy on the South China Sea that was kind of entrepreneurial. He was killing ducks by the thousands, and he was saving all their feathers, and he showed me the warehouse where he had all these feathers, and I said, what in the heck are you going to do with all these feathers, man? And he said, this war isn't going to last forever, man, and when it's over, I'm going to have the feathers for the pillows, and I'm going to be the duck feather king. So he was the duck feather king, and then we had a getaway place called Vung Tau, which is a beautiful resort on the South China Sea, and I went down to Vung Tau and enjoyed my pineapples carved like ice cream cones on the beach, and did stories with guys that had come out of severe combat situations who were enjoying a few days away. I did stories on the Buddhist temples and Kaodai temples and Buddhist temples up near Tainan. And Tainan, we found out after the war, the mountain was called Nui Ba Din, and that mountain was catacombed with multi-floor hospitals, storage depots, and in fact, the deadliest of our enemies were right in front of us under our eyes, and we couldn't see them. They were within the mountain running a complete military operation like NORAD, and we're buzzing around the top of the mountain and the outside of the mountain, wondering what's going on, and they're running their assault on us from the inside. So just a lot of stories. I did a story on...
Let me stop you on that, because it was fascinating. In one of my own cases some years ago, not too many years ago, I was across the table from a fellow who worked for an insurance company that covered the damages, or would cover the damages, to a fellow we were representing who had been wrongfully convicted of a murder and spent 14 years in prison because some cop had done some very bad things to get him convicted. But at any rate, during the course of this meeting, this insurance fellow, kind of a mild-mannered guy, said to my client, you know, Mr. Souter, I can't tell you how sorry I am that this happened to you, that you were wrongfully convicted. The only thing I can compare it to is when I was in Vietnam. I was on the top at a fire support base on the top of a mountain, and we were surrounded by the Viet Cong and the NVA, and it was just a rough deal. And I said, I thought to myself, wait a minute, what was that place called? And he said, well, that was called Nui Ba Den, the Black Virgin Mountain. I said, my brother was down in the bottom, and he helped an assault, or he covered an assault of the middle part of that island.
It's the first place I got shot at, on the way to Nui Ba Din. Was headed to fire support base Buell, and a guy popped up behind a tombstone because the matriarch or patriarch of the family could be buried anywhere they wanted on their farm, so you'd see water buffalo out there plowing a field, and then you'd see a tombstone. Well, this clown popped up behind the tombstone and decided he wanted to put a hole in my head, and that was one of my first get-togethers around Nui Ba Din. It was a charming place to be from.
All right, Frank, what kind of stories did you cover?
Well, some of the more memorable ones include the FAMF, which was Floating Aircraft Maintenance Facility, and for security, a lot of the really serious repairs on helicopters were done on the Army ship. One ship the Army had that was off the coast of Vung Tau flew in on a helicopter, and down below decks was a complete shop for refitting the engines. And, you know, these guys had a much different experience because they were almost in Vietnam, almost but not quite.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, you know, it was out at sea for security's sake. We covered serious stories. We covered fluff. One I covered was called Arclight, which was a military operation, nighttime military operation. And, excuse me, Arclight was something completely different. Arclights were B-52 carpet bombing.
Right.
This was called Firefly. And it was called Firefly because it would be a helicopter flying completely dark, no lights at all. And they had night scopes, and they would determine where the enemy was. And the Firefly would come in when it would begin firing on an enemy position. And the tracer bullets could be compared to the light of a Firefly, so to speak. Completely opposite type of story I covered was a demonstration match between the U.S. and the Vietnamese Davis Cup teams, which is how I got to meet Arthur Ashe.
And Mrs. Tu, President.
Oh, this is President Tu, yeah.
Who was also there.
She was there in her beauty, that's for sure.
There is a story that a fellow I worked for was Attorney General of the United States, and he, when he was a tough guy, and so he said, "Well, I want to tell you something. That I now come into office as Deputy Attorney General." He's putting on sort of a pseudo Asian accent, and I want to tell you, in the words of Air Admiral Vice Air Admiral Nguyen Cao Ky, upon ascending to the presidency of the Republic of Vietnam, he said, "I got two lists, them what gotta go, and them what gotta go next."
Yeah.
All this produced something in the three of you and all the people who have been at this reunion. And I've heard this phrase over and over. You repeated it, Cliff, earlier, band of brothers. This brotherhood, your views are, I'm not going to get into your political views, but they're different. You came out of it with different points of view. Whether you brought those in or you developed them while you were there, something happened to each of you. What did you take out of the time that you were there? What came out of it for you? What is the lasting memory? And why are you guys considered, with all these differences, your different backgrounds, different parts of the United States, what brings you together?
Well, I think you can just go so far away from home, in this case 14,800 miles, and you're headed home the backside. So when you take malleable, intelligent young souls and you put them together in a combat environment where they've essentially had educational and on-the-job training to do a job, there's a certain likeness that brings you all together, though some of you may be two clicks to the right of Attila the Hun politically, and the other may be two clicks to the left of Hillary Clinton. So it's really not about politics, it's about serving our nation. It was about serving our selves and growing ourselves and our careers, and it was about getting home safe together. And there was such a myriad of events and things occurring around the world, emotionally and politically in our lives. I mean, we had guys that had to go home and divorce their wives because they were pregnant by other men. I mean, we were fast operating in an adult society. In a post-college time period is what it amounted to. And I think those experiences bound us together as brothers. The battles we saw, the death, the stink, that bound us together as brothers. And we hadn't essentially seen each other for 45, 46 years until last year, except for the few of us that had stuck together on an individual basis. And I think my friends would agree with me. We just continue a conversation as though we just walked out of the room and came back.
Camaraderie, shared experiences, and what really helped those of us who were in the 16th is that we all had similar backgrounds, meaning that we were all journalists, even though we came from different parts of the country. And I think that the fact we were doing a job similar to what we planned to do in civilian life, at least in my case, helped us cope as we went along.
And we were given a lot of authority. I mean, we were ultimately responsible to a general, we all carried press credentials that allowed us essentially to commandeer any helicopter or any jeep, anything we needed to get our job done and to proceed at our own volition anywhere within the geographical limits of Vietnam to do it. So if I needed a chopper, I just went and got a chopper and went where I wanted to go. So it was a good thing, because as young persons that wanted to make a difference in what we did, we actually had been given direct authority by the U.S. Army to do our job without intervention. And a lot of guys were slogging around in the mud, burning leeches off their legs with rifles with PhDs. So we were blessed to be able to do what we were trained to do and given the authority to do it.
The freedom. And I'll get back to the Band of Brothers, but one of the stories I worked on, the most memorable, was I had two stories where I interviewed some North Vietnamese prisoners of war, and in a different setting, I interviewed some Viet Cong prisoners of war, and they told me about their experiences, and they told me about their training, and they told me about their background. One of them told me about a movie where it was a John Wayne kind of movie where Russians played the Americans who were the villains, and, you know, it was very interesting, and they had one bullet a week to practice with, you know, because they had very little resources and so on. Now, the Band of Brothers things, I think what these guys have said is absolutely right. And what surprises me is there's something like it is like we picked up yesterday. I also think that I think it would have been different if we had gotten together when we were 40. I've also been having reunions with childhood friends. And these guys are childhood friends because we weren't much more than children. And I think it's a reunion with your own youth. These guys were there when I was not much more than a child. And they know me when I was young. They know the real me before the artifices get piled on.
And we like him, you know, we still like him anyway. In spite of himself, you know.
Well, you know, I saw his picture on the post office here, you know, on the walls.
Right. Was it Arnold? But his hair was black in that picture, right. And now it's snow white, so he won't be caught. Yeah.
And that's the first time I've seen him stunned. He can't say anything further.
Well, I think he's wondering, is it really on the wall? You
know? No, I'm trying to contemplate that I think I'm viewed as someone who speaks in a way. Actually, I had a guy at the newspaper once who I said something to him about something, and he says, "You speak like some of the books I'm reading in a master's degree literature program at college."
All right, here's the deal. You were all drafted, or came very close to being drafted, and you joined up in lieu of being drafted. Different army today. All volunteer army, no draft. We haven't had a draft since shortly after the Vietnam War. What do you think?
Well, I'm absolutely amazed at the quality, caliber, initiative, and leadership that these young people have taken on in support of patriotism of our nation and gone out and volunteered to serve our nation. And I can't say enough for them. I have a nephew who's a West Point graduate, who's a captain serving. I have another nephew who's getting ready to head to Somalia and Special Forces, and I just think we're blessed to have the caliber of young men and women in our services today. And for myself, I'm equally disappointed in the lack of leadership at the top in our government, that the resource and the blood offered is squandered more often than not, in my opinion.
I think it's too bad that we don't have a draft, because we have global responsibilities where whether we should be there or not is a different issue. But if we're going to be the great world power, then we have to have a military that reflects us all. And it's a way out for the politicians. Now they don't have to worry about declaring a war somewhere, because all of us are not going to be fighting it. A lot of what fueled the anti-war movement in the Vietnam era was, is this worth dying for? Well, we're not going to die for it. Our kids aren't going to die for it. And it distances us. And I think it's very dangerous for democracy if you're going to have wars because you're a world power and you're going to need to exercise that power on occasion. To have people not be responsible, it's dangerous.
And I'm not advocating a return of the draft, but I feel for the young people, people who are the age we were when we went over. There should be some sort of national service, serving their communities, serving the government, joining the Peace Corps.
Yeah, I think that's a great point, and the fact that not everybody wants to bear arms, not everybody emotionally is ready to pull the trigger on an enemy. You can probably find as many people that want to debate the issue of ISIS from the left or the right. But the fact of the matter is, we live in the greatest nation on earth. We live in a nation that has essentially given blood every 20 years since our inception in a war to remain free. And one of the things I have high respect for the state of Israel is that when you're 18 years old, you're going to serve your nation for 2 years. If a woman can't have an interest in the combat issues or in military service, she can do something else. But I believe all Americans should serve. We should all have a dog in the hunt. That's the way I look at it.
I agree.
Don, if you were going to change something about your experience in the command situation or the service that you, the group that you were with, what would it be?
I would not change anything. I was very, very, very lucky. We all were. Now, some of the guys saw some meaner stuff than I saw. I did experience briefly a combat situation, but I never faced fear. I never faced death. And as Cliff said, we were free to do what we want. It was virtually a civilian job. And our commander, who ran the newspaper, and the commander above him, who he gave credit for giving him the freedom, they gave us the freedom to write stories. The stories that I wrote about the North Vietnamese soldiers and the Viet Cong soldiers, they were expressing anti-American viewpoints, and those got in the story. And it was not a story that I think you'd say was slanted like in some liberal way. It was just reporting on what these people said. And it was a great experience. Very, very, very lucky.
I think the point that Don made that is the most salient and the strongest point that no one seems to make allusion to is the fact that, like he said, is this worth dying for? You can decide whether Iraq was worth the lives and blood and treasure. You can decide whether Afghanistan was worth the blood and treasure. I have 58,000 plus brothers that died and never got to their 24th birthday. I had 340,000 brothers that were wounded. And I have a hard time finding anything that we accomplished in Vietnam whatsoever. So I just think Don makes a great point in that politicians shouldn't be able to sweep our military needs under the rug, under the guise that, well, if 3% are serving, 97% aren't. So so many times in Washington, it's the poll that runs the deal. And I think Americans need to get involved with our government, and if you can't do it by serving in the military, then serve another way. But our politicians need to be held accountable when they use our blood and treasure. We need to know why we're going. We need to know what the clear-cut accomplishment is going to be, and we need to know the reality of what's the chances of achieving that goal. And quite frankly, I haven't seen that in modern times since the Second World War. My father, my four uncles, all volunteered the same day that Pearl Harbor was bombed, and they knew they were in the military for the duration, and they knew we could lose the war. And I really don't think Americans have had any sense whatsoever from the Second World on out through Korea, Vietnam, Afghanistan, Iraq, that our country was ever really under a threat. So,
but I disagree with Cliff in one respect. I went to the wall in Washington, and I looked at the wall, and I was very surprised at my reaction. I was going, because I wasn't in combat, I didn't know anybody who died. And I went to the wall and I cried because I looked at all those names. And I've heard from other people, you know. I looked at those names and I said, and here's the thought that occurred to me. You didn't die in vain, because I have this theory. First of all, the Russians experienced the same thing in Afghanistan. That was their Vietnam. It helped to bring down communism. And our guys who went there, the fact that they had to go, it prompted the anti-war movement. And I have to believe that when Soviet propaganda was talking about the evil imperialist people and all of the, you know, the American imperialist dogs, and we're in Vietnam and we're imperialists, that they were showing pictures of the girl putting a flower. They were showing pictures of the girl putting a flower in the barrel of the rifle of the soldier. The peace, the flower children. Yeah. And they were getting that as propaganda. And when their Vietnam came, they remembered that. And I think they remembered, they said, well, wait a minute. In America, they actually were free to protest. In America, they showed us the propaganda stuff. The girl putting the flower in the barrel of the gun. And those people didn't all get carted off to the gulag. And I believe that had a role, that back and forth with the anti-war movement and the war that these soldiers fought for, that they were part of it that brought down the Soviet Union. Not because we stood there, but because of that whole dynamic.
Frank, you get the last word.
Well, we did have a little wake-up call that it's a very dangerous world about 14 years ago. Nobody expected 9/11. Nobody expected the planes to be flown into the Twin Towers, into the Pentagon, into the field in Shanksville, Pennsylvania. And those people who were behind that have morphed into something different. And it's really a different type of warfare out there now. There's no front.
You know, the interesting thing, and this is a book written in the 400s by Augustine, Saint Augustine of Hippo, called The City of God, and the first section of it talks about the shock to the entire Roman world with when the barbarians first got in and torched the city of Rome. And he wrote about that as, this is the end of the world. That was his idea, what the beginning of the end of the world was. There is a certain image that I have in my mind of looking at the Twin Towers and saying, all of a sudden, the wake-up call comes. The wake-up call comes, that we are as vulnerable as the Romans were.
The Etruscans are in New York.
Yeah, the Etruscans are in New York. Gentlemen, thank you very much. This has been a great hour with you. It went by too quickly. I wish you all the best. I'm glad to have been invited by you to be a part of your band of brothers, and I take it as a great honor. The name of our program is With Respect. We are on every Sunday morning at 11 and every Thursday morning at 10. And remember, until next time, our mantra is, if you show respect to other people, they will show respect to you.